session number 27344, Reel 30.
Robert Candlelight, Reel 30.
Yes, we were talking about the mattresses being fouled, and you were asking if it was a big problem amongst the petty officers and chief petty officers. Well, obviously they were older men, more mature and less likely to. But the drawback goes back to this argument I had when I was in the personnel panel about too many chiefs and not enough Indians. And the reason that this developed so badly in the Fleet Air Arm was somebody, somewhere, decided that the skilled men in the Navy were not going to be paid for their skill. So that an artificer, who is a very skilled man, would not be paid for his skill as an artificer. And to persuade them to become artificers and to justify it, they would be promoted instead. So they were given a higher salary because they became petty officers or chief petty officers. And this applied right across the ranks, whether they were air mechanics or stokers or whatever it was. If they had a skill which justified their having extra pay, they got it by being promoted. So we had petty officers who were not as experienced and not as old as the old three-badge ABs. And you, to be honest, you would get people becoming chief petty officers before they were entitled to have their first good conduct badge. And that is absolutely terrible, because a man wearing chief petty officer's buttons in the Navy forever had been respected, because they knew he'd been through the mill and he knew what he was talking about and he would help you or blast you. But now we got to the stage where you had men wearing chief petty officer's buttons and they didn't know as much as the men they were supposed to be controlling. And it led to some really sad situations. And this was why I was so against people being promoted to petty officer and chief petty officer before their time, and it was happening. And then to say at the end of it you were going to give them fourth and fifth fives as well, you would have had more chief petty officers than any other rank in the Navy. A ridiculous situation. So I think the fact that some petty officers were very young, and even some chief petty officers, this business of fouling the beds did occur, but less and less as you went up through the ranks. But anyway, I was at Leon Solent, and I finished my time in the Navy. I'd volunteered to retire, and I left in July 67.
Were you given any advice or help on returning to civilian life after that?
Yes, the whole variety of courses were offered, and places you could go. And, for example, there was one organisation called the White Ensign Club, and that was intended to provide advice to people leaving the service to help them get into other jobs, because although I may have been a fairly reasonable fighter pilot, there aren't many of those in civilian life. So it was a matter of trying to determine what other skills I had that could be used in civilian life.
Because you had returned to civilian life, hadn't you, after your war service initially?
Yes.
Back to brewing.
That's right.
Was that an issue that you might have wanted to return to that area?
While I was in the Navy, I did qualify in work study as well. And I thought, well, I could use that perhaps. And I noticed in one of the papers an advertisement from Whitbread's in London looking for a work study officer. So I wrote and I said, well, I'm qualified in work study. And I'm also qualified in brewing. I'm an associate member of the Institute of Brewing. And I thought, I'll walk into the job. I didn't even get an answer. While I was in the last 4 or 5 months of my time as first lieutenant, I started writing to companies asking about the possibility of a job when I left, giving them a leaving date in July. And I must have written best part of 150 letters. I suppose I had responses from about half of them. I had 7 invitations for interview, and I did get a job. I got a job as work-study officer at the Oxford University Press. But there were always opportunities when I was leaving the service to go and do courses which would help me in getting established in civilian life.
And what about your last day? Was there any? Did you have any personal celebrations, or was it just a matter of leaving?
Oh yes, well, the personal celebration was the wardroom mess dined me out, and that, of course, was really rather good because I had joined the Navy at Leon Solent. I was commissioned at Leon Solent. I was married at Leon Solent. And I left the Navy from Leon Solent. So that really played quite a big part in my life. And I had enjoyed it.
I was going to say, could you sum up for me how you feel now about having served with the Fleet Air?
Well, I loved it. It was absolutely ideal sort of life for a single man. But for a married man, it really was quite difficult because the politicians were always reducing the size of the service and asking them to do the same number of jobs that they'd been doing before with fewer men, fewer aircraft and fewer ships. And the trouble there was that those who stayed in the service were spending much more time at sea, where we had spent perhaps 50% of our time at sea, we are now spending 70, 75%. Maybe even 80% of our time at sea. And although I always enjoyed my flying and I enjoyed sea time, I knew that back at home, my wife had one child at that time to look after. And she had to do it all, of course, the disciplining and all the rest of it. And when I came home on a fortnight's leave, I couldn't sort of immediately assume that I was the boss and everyone was going to stand to attention because my wife was going to have to take it over again as soon as I went back at the end of the fortnight. So it was a difficult time for her, and it wasn't an easy time for me going back, and it's the same for all of us in the service with these short terms back ashore. And the other drawback was that I loved the flying, I really did. And, for example, when we were at Lossiemouth, we'd been at sea and we'd come ashore to Lossiemouth, and I was always instructing when I was at Lossiemouth. I was an instructor or senior pilot or CO. And, for example, when I was CO of the training squadron, we would be there ashore, flying every day, half days on Saturdays as well, we were in, and night flying 3 or 4 times a week. So you were seeing very little of the family, even when you were ashore. And it was always a strain on the marriage relationship. And I was surprised, looking back on it, how few divorces there were. But unfortunately, the marriages weren't all as happy as they might have been if Dad had been around a bit more. So, in fact, I enjoyed my life thoroughly in the Fleet Air Arm. And I was sad to leave, but I really wanted to carry on flying frontline aircraft, and I felt capable of doing it. And I was sorry I missed out on the developing aircraft, like the Buccaneer, for example. I'd love to have flown the Buccaneer. Or the Phantom, for that matter. They were both marvellous aircraft and they were good fleet air arm aircraft.
I think actually it's one thing we haven't discussed. You did fly the Hunter, didn't you?
Yes.
Because I don't think we discussed that. Could you let me know a little bit about the Hunter, what that was like as an
aircraft? Oh, it's a beautiful aircraft. Beautiful aircraft to fly. It's the one thing I enjoyed about my time at the Central Fighter Establishment was I was invited to fly with the students who were there on what they called the Day Fighter Leader Course. And this was reasonably senior pilots in the RAF who were being trained to be squadron COs. And I was the same sort of seniority and flying experience, so I was invited to fly with them. And that was great. I thoroughly enjoyed it. The Hunter is a beautiful aircraft to fly. Every bit as comfortable and nice to fly as I thought the Seahawk was, but a much better aircraft. Faster and could fly higher, and it was a better fighter aircraft at altitude. And I did enjoy it. I can remember one occasion we did a low-level strike from West Raynham on Tain Range in the north of Scotland. Now, Tain Range was the bombing range for Lossiemouth. And we did a bombing raid on Tain Range, dropped our practice bombs and landed at Lossiemouth. And we had done an awful lot of that as a low-level trip. And a low-level trip through the Highlands is always exciting. But, yes, I thoroughly enjoyed the Hunter. Lovely aircraft. And the one advantage, well, the one advantage, one was able to fly it supersonic in a shallow dive. You could go supersonic. But we were always told that if we were going supersonic, we had to do it out over the North Sea.
What are the effects of an aircraft going supersonic?
None.
Is there a bang, though?
No. The bang's on the ground. The thing is, as you become supersonic, I've had this explained to me, but I couldn't explain it to you now. But the bang is on the ground. There's a boom, boom. And that is why we were always made to do it out over the sea, because if you were fairly low level and delivered this sonic bang, you could break glass windows quite easily. So we were discouraged from doing that. Yeah, I enjoyed flying the Hunter with the men on the course.
Thank you very much.